So growing up in Israel, my guest, Tal Ben-Shahar, he wanted to be the best squash player, not just in the country, but in the world. And he turned pro at a pretty young age and quickly rose up the ranks. Then this weird thing happened. He achieved his dream. But then he crashed hard, realizing it didn't make him feel how he thought he would feel. And that experience set in motion this lifelong sort of quest into the science of happiness that led him eventually to study in the United States at Harvard and eventually teach what became the most popular course at Harvard on happiness. Tal is now a best-selling author and lecturer, working with executives and multinational corporations, everyday humans, and at-risk populations, exploring everything from leadership, happiness, education, innovation, ethics, self-esteem, resilience, goal setting, and mindfulness. His books have been translated into more than 25 languages and have appeared on bestseller lists around the world. Tal is also a serial entrepreneur and is most recently the co-founder and chief learning officer of Happiness Studies Academy, which is all about bringing together the thinking of the world's leading scholars and the latest scientific research on happiness, and then educating and training leaders who are themselves really dedicated to personal, interpersonal, and communal flourishing. So excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that you or a loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. Growing up, I know it seems like squash for you was really the thing that was not just a passion, but almost an obsession.
Very much so. You know, I remember when I was 16 years old and very, very much into squash, waking up one morning and having the following thought, which was, what will I do with my life when I no longer play squash? Because, you know, at least as a professional athlete, you know that you have quite a short half-life. And I thought, what will I do when I'm, you know, 30 or 35 with my life? And of course, my decision was then, you know, I will become a coach. I thought of becoming the Israeli national coach at that time. but could not see my life without it.
Mm. The notion of you as a 16-year-old thinking about what comes next, before you had actually sort of like stepped into the ultimate, you know, like what you were aspiring to do, is an unusual thought process for, I think, any 16-year-old.
Yeah, you know, there are certain people who are more inclined to reflection or rumination. I'm certainly one of them. I think among psychologists, there is a disproportionate number of them. And, you know, it's both a blessing and a curse. So, you know, Socrates, the father of Western philosophy, once said that the unexamined life is not worth living. But I have to add a second part to that sentence, which is that the over-examined life is tedious. I certainly have fallen into the trap of tedium throughout my life, also when I was 16.
Yeah, which is sort of an interesting tell just about, and almost like a little bit of foreshadowing as to what would come over a period of years. I know you rose up, as you mentioned, you had this huge aspiration to be at the top of the squash world and to really be, I guess, the Israeli national champion. And you did it. You know, you actually, you know, you put in the work, you rose up the ranks, you did what you came to do. But it seems like that was a bit of a double-edged sword for you.
Yeah, it was, because it brought home at that time a very surprising truth. So specifically, for many years while I was training and playing, I wasn't happy. But worse than that, I constantly felt stressed. There was a knot in my stomach, which was always there and wouldn't, well, it went away once in a while whenever I, you know, won a big match, or when I had the near perfect training session. But it was rare, and the norm was the knot. However, I always believed, in fact, I was certain that knot would go away once I achieved my goal. Once I reached my dream, which at that time was to be the national champion. And I got there, and I realized when I got there that there was no there. Meaning, for the first few hours, I felt elation, probably happier than I'd ever been, certainly up to that point. However, within a few hours, the same knot returned, and the elation that I felt just a short while earlier turned into real deep despair, because the model that gave me hope for so many years that, you know, this will be over, you know, the pain, I'm not talking about the pain of training hard. That was trivial by comparison, you know. Yeah, so you're tired, you're sore, that's the life of a professional athlete. But the physical pain with a psychological cause, I mean, that was unbearable. And especially once I realized that it won't go away once I fulfilled my dream. And the thing, though, is that very quickly I went into the next stage, which for me was, okay, so what I have to do now in order to get rid of this knot is win the world championship, because the national championship obviously is not enough. It's not a high enough aspiration. And I started again, like Sisyphus. You know, the stone was rolled down the mountain and I had to climb a steeper mountain. It wasn't the same incline. So again, for years, I aspired to become the world champion, believing that winning that would alleviate the discomfort, dis-ease. I never got to win the world championship. I won a few international championships, but got injured at a relatively young age and a career-ending injury. But I replaced that squash aspiration with different ones. And specifically, initially at least, it was, okay, get into a top college, you know, get into Harvard, which I did. And then it's get the best grades, and then get a good job, and on and on. And at some point, I just realized that I probably had it wrong. You know, that it's not about the external. It's not about achieving this or that milestone. that it was more about me changing my perception, the internal rather than the external world. And that's when I turned to psychology.
Yeah, I mean, it occurs to me listening to your story and also sort of folding that in with so many conversations I've had over the years with people who have sacrificed so much of their lives to rise to meet this one expectation of being the best of the best in any domain or whatever that internal or familial or societal, you know, like definition of success was, and then met it and immediately after fell into this anywhere from malaise to really deep depression. It was interesting. I talked to a former Olympian not too long ago who actually medaled. She did exactly what she came to do and went into a very, very dark place after, and then started talking to her friends who were all other fellow Olympians and noticed an astonishing prevalence of this same exact phenomenon. And I'm curious, you describe it as almost this existential feeling of, okay, what now? Like that didn't give me the feeling I wanted to feel. So what now? I wonder how much of the feeling is that, and also the feeling of waking up and for years having this thing that you're striving for, a purpose, and then you wake up the next morning and it's no longer there. And then when you blend those two things together, it just creates this compound effect.
Yeah, the perfect storm. So yeah, this is a pervasive phenomenon. And take the example of someone who's unhappy as a child, unhappy as a young adult, but has a goal, has a dream to become, say, a movie star. You know, let's take the most probably admired, respected, and rewarded of all stardoms. And you know, for many years, he's weighing tables at restaurants, but he's constantly sustained by the belief that once he makes it, then he'll be happy. And then eventually, years later, year after years of pain and suffering, he makes it. And he's ecstatic, elated, happier than he had ever been before. And, for a month, for 2 months, for a year, it could not be better, because now he can have any man or woman he wants, because he's admired, revered, because now he can buy anything he wants. He's wealthy. He has it all. And then after a year, suddenly the knot that perhaps he had or the dis-ease that he experienced returns, because it inevitably does. And now he's lost, because at least before he had the hope that once he makes it, then he'll be happy. But he made it. And again, he realized that there is no there. You know, the difference between sadness and depression is that depression is sadness without hope. Before he had hope, now he no longer has hope. And he realizes that he cannot find happiness in this reality. So he looks for answers outside of reality. What's outside of reality? Well, it could be alcohol or drugs or the ultimate exit from reality, which is suicide. And this is why we have so many very successful people putting an end to their lives or turning to drugs and alcohol, because the model that they had, the model that we are taught from a very young age, just disintegrated, fell apart. And there is no good alternative model that is out there for them to grasp on.
Yeah, when I want to actually go into like what would a new model look like? Like if we were to reimagine, what are the contributing factors to happiness? Let's talk about some of those things. But before we get there, I think it actually makes sense to ask a more fundamental question, which is, when we talk about happiness, what are we actually talking about?
You know, there are many definitions to happiness. Some people have given up on trying to define it, and they simply say, well, it's like beauty. You know, you can't define it, but you know it when you see it, or you know it when you experience it. I'm not of that school of thought. I think it is important to define happiness, because once we define it, it can help us find it, achieve it. You know, there's a lovely line, the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland, where she asks the Cheshire Cat, you know, where should I go? And he says, well, that depends on where you want to get to. And then she says, well, I don't know where I want to get to. And then he says, well, then it doesn't matter where you go. So I think it is important to know where we're going, to define our path. So my definition of happiness comprises five elements. The first element of happiness is spiritual well-being. Spiritual well-being, very briefly, can of course come from religion, but it doesn't have to. It can come from a sense of meaning and purpose in life, or from being present to whatever it is that we're experiencing, to the miracle of existence. So meaning and presence are the two elements of a spiritual life. Physical well-being, the second element of happiness, is about regular physical exercise, about movement, about sleep, about nutrition. Of course, these are important elements of happiness. Then there is intellectual well-being. You know that there is research showing that being curious, asking questions, learning constantly and consistently doesn't just make us happier. It also makes us healthier. In fact, contributes to longevity, being a lifelong learner. So that's intellectual well-being, engaging with texts or with nature or with a work of art. That's intellectual well-being. Then there is relational well-being, interpersonal relationships, also relationship with oneself. The number one predictor of happiness is quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us. And finally, there is emotional well-being. Emotional well-being is about dealing with painful emotions, sadness, anger, envy, anxiety, and also cultivating pleasurable emotions like joy, like gratitude, like love, like excitement. So these five elements, spiritual, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional well-being, that make up the acronym SPIRE, are the building blocks of happiness. Now, it doesn't mean we need to have it all. That would be overwhelming to even think about having it all. But it does mean that given that we are a system, a whole system, we can find an in towards increasing levels of happiness through any one, any and all of these five elements. So we can meditate, or we can exercise, or we can engage in learning, or we can invest more in our relationships, or express gratitude. I mean, these are all powerful, impactful ways of increasing levels of happiness, especially if we practice them consistently and constantly. So ritualizing them is, of course, important.
Yeah, and I want to dive into some of those in a bit more detail. Curiosity came to me as you're sharing that when you describe these five elements, the second word in each one of the qualifiers is well-being. Having spent some time with some of the research on happiness and money over time, it's been interesting to see that, you know, one of the big illusions was that, you know, we thought that for every dollar earned, you know, there would be X percent more happiness. And in fact, you know, that peaks out at a certain level of income. But what was interesting for me to see was, and you're going to be much more familiar with the details of this research than I am, but I do recall seeing a follow-up wave of research that then looked at a vastly larger global data set and looked at the relationship between income and not just happiness, but they broke out as a separate measure, subjective well-being. And they looked at them as two distinct things. And what they found from my recollection is that there is this leveling off, you know, and I think in the US it was around $75,000 a year in income, something like that, where it didn't matter how much more you made, happiness pretty much just flatlined. But subjective well-being continued in a linear relationship up with every dollar more that you made. The data set stopped at around $250,000 a year, so they didn't go beyond that. So I'm curious what you feel is the relationship between these things.
Yes, so the relationship between money and happiness is that money matters up to a certain point. So that point is essentially where you feel like your basic needs are met, whether it's for shelter, for food, of course, for education. Beyond that, money doesn't make that much of a difference to your happiness levels unless you know how to spend it wisely. Now, specifically, there are two ways that we know we can spend money wisely. One is on experiences rather than things. And two, it's on giving. And let me elaborate a little bit on each one of those. So they asked people, what do you think will make you happier? Buying, you know, if you have discretionary income, you know, say $10,000, would it be on upgrading your car thing, or, you know, going on a vacation with your loved ones? And most people said, well, we think a car, you know, if that is something that I want, would make me happier because a vacation is over in 2 weeks. A car I'll have 3 years from now. Well, it turns out that their intuition was wrong, and that a vacation, an experience, actually yielded more long-term happiness in most cases. Again, this is, of course, an average generalization, but in most cases, it yielded more happiness than buying a thing, because a thing you get used to, you adapt to. You know, you're excited about the car initially, and then very quickly it just becomes a car, another car that you own, unless you're, a car expert or a racer, and then you have experiences with the car. But in most cases, when it's about something, we get tired of it. Or even if we don't get tired of it, we stop noticing it. It's the novelty that's important. As Daryl Bem, a Cornell psychologist, said, the exotic is erotic. But once it becomes an everyday occurrence, it's less exciting. Whereas with experiences, what you're doing, you are cultivating relationships. Because, again, I'm talking about most vacations. Some vacations mean the end of relationships, of course. But in most cases, it strengthens the connections among people. And that is a very important predictor, antecedent of happiness. So that's one element. Choose experiences over things once basic needs are met, of course. The second element is giving. So I'll share a study, and actually I'm bringing together a few studies into one here. This was done through a joint University of British Columbia, Canada, and Harvard Business School research. And what they did was they brought in people to a lab and they measured their levels of happiness. And then they gave them a nice sum of money. And then they said to them, go spend this money on yourself, go buy yourself something. And they did. And they bought themselves a gadget or shoes or whatever. And then they came back to the lab and they measured their levels of happiness again. And what they found was that their happiness levels went up significantly as a result of the shopping spree. You know, this is important research. This is the first time in recorded history that we have scientific evidence for Carrie Bradshaw's claim from Sex and the City that buying shoes makes you happier. So that's good so far. Not so good if we go a little further. A day later, they went back to the lab and they measured their levels of happiness again. What did they find? They were right back where they started. In other words, there was a shopper's high that lasted less than 24 hours. Second part of the same study, they bring in another group of people and they measure their levels of happiness. And once again, they give them the exact same amount of money that they gave the first group. And once again, they tell them, go spend this money. Only this time they tell them, go spend it on someone else. Now, spending it on someone else can be, you know, buying homeless people meals. It could be donating it to your favorite charity. It could be buying a colleague or a friend shoes. Go spend it on someone else. And then they go back to the lab and they measure their levels of happiness. What do they find? Happiness levels go up to the same degree as the shoppers, with one very big difference. A day later, when they measured their levels of happiness again, it did go down slightly, but it was still significantly higher than base level. Even after a week, they saw the impact, the positive impact for well-being of giving. So to give in so many ways is to receive. You know, my mother tongue is not English. English is my second language. My mother tongue is Hebrew. And in Hebrew, and this is a biblical word, in Hebrew, the word for giving is Natan. And Natan, like the name Nathan, that's the biblical name. And if you spell Natan, whether you do it in Hebrew or you do it with Roman letters, it's a palindrome. So N-A-T-A-N, or in Hebrew, Nun Taf Nun. You would read it the same left to right and right to left. No coincidence here. There is a deep meaning to this word, because today, this is verified by a lot of research, we know that when we give, we're given right back with interest.
The giver's glow.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lumi. So listen, we have all had those awkward moments where a BO strikes at the worst possible time. I'm often actually out in nature when I'm exercising, so I don't even notice it when I'm out. And then I walk in the door, kind of start to wrinkle my nose. And then I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's actually me. That is why I'm so thankful I discovered Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. This revolutionary product, it was actually invented by an OBGYN who wanted a solution for her patients struggling with private odor. But Lumi doesn't just work, quote, down there. It provides incredible 72-hour protection for your entire body using mandelic acid. I kid you not, this stuff is a game changer. Lumi is safe and effective for pits, for feet, you name it. And as someone who's tried it, I can attest that it seriously works. The fresh scents are just an added bonus. So if you're ready to say goodbye to BO for good, try Lumi's starter pack. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with the code GOODLIFE at LumiDeodorant.com. Don't miss your chance to experience the relief of true full body freshness that equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com or just click the link in the show notes and use the code GOODLIFE. Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince. So my wife actually originally introduced me to Quince because she loves their clothing, and I have been hooked ever since. I literally lived in their Mongolian cashmere ribbed beanie and pullover hoodie pretty much all winter. And as the weather warms up, I wanted more breathable summer pieces without overpaying. And Quince has just the super high quality items like linen shirts, performance polos, activewear at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman to pass savings to customers. Actually just ordered a new European linen long sleeve button down shirt. Super excited to get that. And I'm always just so amazed at how they can keep their prices so affordable while the quality remains really high. So if you're looking to upgrade your wardrobe, I highly recommend you try Quince. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and a 365-day return. That's quince.com/GLP to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP or just click the link in the show notes. Trust me, your wardrobe will thank you. You know, it's interesting when you think about giving, it makes sense when, especially when you sort of explain the reciprocal energy, that it would feel good. I remember sitting down with Adam Grant a couple of years back. We were talking about something similar. You know, he's done a whole bunch of work on how giving affects different people in different ways. And he was actually citing, I think it was Sonia Lubomirsky, who did this work, because I think counterintuitively, I think very often, tell me if I have this right, we feel like well, if we give a little bit every day, then we can kind of keep that giver's glow going for a long time. And yes, it's good for other people and it's better for us. But is it true, in fact, that the research showed that, in fact, that if you actually cluster your giving in something like one day a week, that it actually has a stronger effect?
Yes. So this is Sonia Lyubomirsky's research on giving. And what she did was she had a control group, of course, that didn't give. And then she had two experimental groups. One group gave five times during the week, and the other group gave five times on one day of the week. And yes, she found more impact for those who concentrated their giving. And, you know, I've often wondered why that is. And what I think it could be is that that giving on one day, you know, gave you sort of a strong dose of the value of giving. Now, that means strong motivation to do it again. So that could very well have created an upward spiral through very strong emotion. I mean, look at the connection between the word emotion, motion, and motivation. They all come from the same root. And it's when we have strong emotions that we are driven to motion, that we have motivation. Perhaps do it again and again and again. So we're creating an upward spiral of giving. And, you know, I do a lot of, I've done a lot of thinking and reflecting on this upward spiral of thinking for a slightly different reason. You know, the field of positive psychology or the science of happiness often comes under attack for being a selfish or for supporting a selfish pursuit. Because, you know, I want to be happier. That's why I'm taking a course on happiness. That's why I'm reading this book. And this is selfish. And, you know, why are you being selfish in a world that needs selflessness, not selfishness, certainly today? But this is a false dichotomy because there's a lot of research showing that when we give others, we feel better about ourselves. That's just one side of the equation, though. There is also research showing that when we cultivate our own happiness, we're much more likely to give. So potentially, we can create an upward spiral between giving to self and giving to others, because giving to others is also giving to ourselves. And when we give to ourselves, we're more likely to give to others. And it's this upward spiral that I think is very important to understand in order to create a synthesis between the selfish camp and the selfless camp. And the synthesis, to my mind, could be called selffulness rather than selfishness or selflessness.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm fascinated by your hypothesis about why that once a week might sort of be more effective at the sprinkling approach every day too. It's almost like it's a bit more of a slingshot up into that broaden and build spiral rather than have kind of simmering at the bottom, you know, like a little bit every day. It never quite launches into the momentum.
Yeah, and again, so that's a great metaphor. The metaphor that I was thinking of as you were speaking was, you know, maybe it's diluted in, you know, in a sea of maybe not unkindness, but in a sea of banal experiences, and it disappears. So it doesn't, it's not recognized, it's not felt as much.
Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned in terms of the relationship to money and happiness and on the spending side, well, a lot of it is, you know, like there are two ways that we can sort of give, was this distinction between experiences and stuff. You know, I'm going to get something versus I'm going to invest in an experience, and the relational nature of experiences and how that may well be at the heart of why it's more effective. Part of my curiosity around this too, I'm fascinated to hear your thoughts, is when you get something, let's say it's a car, using your example, you're driving that car every day, you have it over a longer period of time, so you have this long sustained opportunity to habituate to just having it. It just doesn't affect you anymore. Most experiences, you know, if you go on a vacation or you go on a really cool adventure, or those are usually these short hits, you know, in the context of your life. It's a day or a week or maybe a month if you're really fortunate. So I wonder if part of what's going on is that you have a much greater opportunity to habituate to the thing that you buy, whereas you don't have that to the experience because it's much more fleeting. I'm curious how that lands with you.
Yeah, so habituation absolutely plays a role here. Daniel Kahneman talks about the hedonic treadmill of, you know, again, enjoying this car initially, but then losing interest to a great extent. And this habituation is important. It's actually a survival mechanism, because if we didn't habituate, then it would mean we wouldn't habituate to painful experiences either. And then we wouldn't be able to survive for long in all likelihood, because most people experience very difficult losses, whether it's a loss of a person, first and foremost, or a loss of identity, or a job, or a relationship. And these losses would be, they are devastating. They would be insurmountable if we didn't habituate. So that's the upside, so to speak, of habituation, that we can habituate to the downside of life. But, you know, there, it's a double-edged sword. We also habituate to the good things, and we can certainly prolong enjoyment of things by being more mindful of the experiences, by expressing gratitude more regularly for the experience. But ultimately, habituation takes place. Whereas when we go on vacation, you know, we can go to, you know, Cancun 1 year and go to the, you know, Catskills the next year, or we can diversify. And this will diminish the likelihood of habituation. In other words, increase the likelihood that we will continue deriving what I've come to call the ultimate currency, the currency of happiness, from these experiences.
Yeah, I wonder if sometimes also, to a certain extent, you can game that impulse, you know. But there's, like you said, there are these sort of unfolding levels of good and bad. You know, it is a double-edged sword. Whereas, you know, the notion that, well, what if you extended that vacation to a year or to a lifetime with the same person or a group of people? Would you then habituate to those people in a way where you started looking for the shiny new friend group, the shiny new partner in life, simply because you've had a longer time to sort of like go back to a baseline and you're not getting that same hit, which would be a devastating thing, you know? And I feel like some of the other things that you've mentioned are ones where, you know, because I think we don't particularly care if we habituate to a car or a thing, but we do care if we habituate to the people that we say we hold dear in our lives. We don't want that relationship to end. So I wonder in circumstances like that, you know, what are the things that we do to counter that sort of innate impulse?
Yes. So, you know, one of the thought experiments that I often run in my class is the following. You know, I say to them, imagine that you're, so first of all, I have a poll in the class and I ask them, so who is the sexiest, most attractive man in the world? And, you know, they vote on it and, you know, it's a different person every year. And then who's the sexiest, most attractive woman in the world? And they vote on it and it changes. And then I say to them, okay, so now imagine that your sexiest man, woman alive is not just that good looking and attractive, also kind, generous, and totally heads over heels in love with you. And, you know, she's smart, interesting, curious. So, you know, anything you ask for, you get in that one person. And you get together and you have, a lustful, loveful relationship. And you're together for 5 years. And basically, you live happily ever after. And then after those 5 years, a psychologist comes in and runs an experiment. And the experiment is to measure your physiological excitement, levels of arousal when a person walks into a room. And, you know, you're hooked up to all these, you know, electrodes, your head, your heart, your what's called galvanic skin response to your hand. You see how much you're sweating from excitement when the person comes in. And and your beloved, your perfect lover partner comes in. And then all the measures are taken. Then 5 minutes later, a person whom you find attractive, moderately attractive, comes in. Where will you be more excited? And the answer physiologically, in most cases, is with the second person. And, you know, many people find this disturbing. Because what does this say? Does this mean that, you know, monogamous relationships ought to be out of the window? That, you know, you can't really sustain, well, you can't sustain lust or love? And the answer is no. There are ways to enjoy lifelong intimate relationships. And again, I'm not here to judge monogamy, polygamy, you know, each her to his, her own. But what I am saying is that those who do choose to be with one person and do want to go on that metaphorical vacation for the rest of their lives, it is possible to find happiness there. However, it takes work. And the kind of work that it takes is investing in the relationship, doing the same things that work and doing new things and experimenting and trying things and opening up gradually but consistently, becoming more and more intimate over time. And the reason why we know this is true is because there are such relationships. They exist. They are not the majority, but they're out there. And the fact that there are such relationships changes the question from, is it possible to enjoy lifelong happiness with one person, to how is it possible to do it? Because some people do it. Most generally, it is, as I said, about work. And there is a common misconception here, because most people believe that once you find your perfect partner, you're ready to live happily ever after. That's a misconception and a dangerous one for long-term happiness. You know, imagine this. Imagine for years you had been looking for your perfect job. And after years and years of searching, you find your perfect job, where it's just the right fit for you. Exactly what you wanted to do, what you were looking for your entire life. A Monday morning comes and your first day of work, you go in to your office. You sit down and you put your feet up on your mahogany desk. And you say to yourself, I found it. I have arrived. And you stay there and you revel in your success, in your happiness. And you stay there more and more, just reveling, enjoying just the accomplishment of having found your perfect ideal job. Before you know it, you'll be fired. Why? Because you need to start working. Not only that, you want to start working. And you do. And you invest more time and more effort than you ever had before. Because this is exactly what you wanted to do with your life. And yet, when it comes to relationship, our model is radically different. Yes, we look for the right partner, and everyone invests in looking for the right person. You sometimes have to kiss many frogs before you find your prince or princess, and you find them. And then what happens? You live happily ever after, or so you hope and think and believe, and that's how you act. Part of the problem comes from movies, because that's how movies are created, constructed. You know, the partners recognize, see each other, they, you know, feel something, but then there is conflict throughout the movie. And then towards the end of the movie, you know, they kiss, they make love, and they live happily ever after. The screen comes down. The problem is that love begins where movies end. And it's the hard work after the falling in love that is the essential ingredient of lifelong happiness with a partner. So investment is essential, indispensable to long-term happiness.
Yeah, I love that. It's interesting. I'm very fortunate to be married to somebody who I love dearly. And you know, we work together and we live together, and we've been married for over 20 years. And just recently, we actually, I think it was last year, John and Julie Gottman came out with this book called 8 Dates, which, you know, ostensibly is you set up 8 dates where you talk about very specific subjects, oftentimes challenging ones. And we looked at that and we thought to ourselves, you know, we've been together now, you know, the better part of 3 decades, married, you know, over 2, you know, okay, we'll try it, but we know each other. And we sat down and we did the work and we're like, wow, there is still so much, not just so much work to do, but so much more to learn, so much more to discover, you know, and also that, you know, you step back into the fact that you are not the same person that you were a decade ago or 2 decades ago. And sometimes you don't share your own inner evolution because there's so much comfort with that other person. And it's really, it's such a stunning gift to be able to actually consciously devote energy to doing that work. And the outcome is really, is staggering. But I agree, you know, the myth is, you know, the curtain goes down and that's it.
Yeah. You know, the Gottmans are great researchers on relationships, and, you know, I teach their work. And then there is someone else whose work I teach, and that is David Schnarch. And David Schnarch has a wonderful book, a book that I owe a lot to, by the name of Passionate Marriage. David Schnarch in the book talks about long-term committed relationships and how they can not just last, but flourish and get better over the years. And one of his key ideas, not the only, but one of the key ideas, is that the most important part of healthy long-term relationship is not what most people think. Most people would say it's about learning to validate one another. And validation is important, and you know, acceptance and unconditional regard of the other is important. But he said that's not the most important thing. He said, rather than being validated, we need to seek to know and to be known. To know and to be known. Why? Because it's through knowing and being known that we cultivate intimacy. And intimacy is the foundation of passion. And if we are to sustain passion, not the relatively superficial one that perhaps we experience on the first date or first year, even the honeymoon phase, but passion that is deep and transcendent almost. And that is what couples can experience after 20 years or even 40 years. Mm. The key, though, is not validation. The key is learning to know and to be known.
Mm, I love that. And now I have a new book for my reading list.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at UH1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When we were talking a little bit earlier, and you were sort of laying out these are the five elements of happiness, the way that you talk about happiness, meaning was a part of that. And I'm fascinated by meaning. You know, when I look at the average midlife crisis, you know, it's not a crisis of money or power or even happiness in my mind. It's an existential crisis. It's a crisis of meaning. You know, and you look at the work of Viktor Frankl and people in that sort of whole canon. And I'm fascinated by the question of, can you be happy without having a significant source of meaning? And is meaningfulness a stronger measure of a life well lived than happiness? Or is it a false dichotomy?
Yes. So I was going to start with the end first. Yes, I do think it's a false dichotomy because meaning is part of happiness. It's not the whole of happiness, but it's part of it. And let me give an extreme example that, at least to me, illustrates why they're not one and the same. You know, Viktor Frankl wrote about finding meaning in a concentration camp. You know, he spent time in Auschwitz, hell on earth. And yet he found meaning, and other inmates found meaning. But to suggest that they were happy in the concentration camp would be, I think, a real stretch and absurd. So they're not one and the same. You also need an element of basic pleasure to experience happiness, or at least the absence of suffering to experience happiness. The thing, though, is, can you experience happiness without meaning? And my argument is that you cannot, that we need to have meaning. However, it's about understanding the full gamut or the full continuum of what it means to find meaning. Viktor Frankl himself makes an important distinction between the meaning of life and the meaning in life. So the meaning of life is basically answers the question, why am I here? What's my ultimate purpose? Many people find it in religion. Many people find it in serving others. Many people find it in serving Mother Earth, you know, in the environmentalist movement. You know, this is a big purpose. This is the meaning of life. This is why I was brought here. However, there is also meaning in life, and meaning in life lowers the bar, and in a healthy and important way. Two reasons. First of all, not everyone finds the meaning of life, and that doesn't mean that they can't experience meaning in their life. And second, even people who do find for themselves the meaning of life, that doesn't mean that at every moment in their life they're connected to that sense of purpose. So we need to lower the bar to a meaningful life. And how do we do that? It's by looking for meaning in our everyday experiences, in the mundane. It's finding the extraordinary in the ordinary. So this is a work that Adam Grant and others did about how we can reframe our current experiences. Amy Wisniewski, Jane Dutton, who had worked with Adam when he was in Michigan, they have done work showing that even janitors in hospitals can find a sense of purpose, meaning, a calling in the work that they do day in and day out. The question is, certainly, you know, teachers can, business people can, hairdressers, engineers, every profession that they researched, they found that there were people who were able to find a sense of meaning and purpose in what they were doing. The question is, how can we raise levels of awareness about it? You know, my business partner, Angus Ridgway spent many years at McKinsey, and you know, we worked together in the field of leadership development through Potential Life. And recently he was having lunch with his brother-in-law. And his brother-in-law is a cardiologist, and his work, his expertise is pacemakers. So basically what he does is puts pacemakers in, and every few years he takes it out and changes batteries and puts it back in. So when they were having lunch, Angus said to him, you know, I finally figured out what you do for a living. So his brother-in-law curiously asks, what? And Angus says, you change batteries for a living. And, you know, his brother, just to give you some background, Angus is British. This is British humor. His brother-in-law looked at him intently, did not even smile. And he said, Angus, you are right. Some days I change batteries. Other days I save lives. So the exact same experience can be interpreted in radically different ways. If I'm a school teacher, you know, I can see my work as a grind. Again, I have to deal with these young, you know, inconsiderate students. Again, I have to teach the same material that I taught last year. Or I can think about my work as cultivating the young minds of the future, of creating a better world. Same work, very different interpretation. And it turns out that interpretation can make all the difference. This is about finding the meaning in life, if not the meaning of life.
No, I love that because it's accessible to anyone and everyone. Like you said, the bigger question of, you know, like even singular purpose or life purpose, you know, I actually really hate that phrase, but just the notion that there is this one thing out there and that, you know, we are destined to find it. Well, maybe somebody does stumble upon it, but a lot of people never will. But this notion of meaning in life, that on any given moment of any given day, you can find a sense of purpose in so many things, even when it's not apparent, when you actually really examine it. So powerful to me. I have two friends that both teach middle school, and one of them kind of ruins the day. Because it is, you know, known as the toughest age of any kid that you could possibly teach. And it's kind of brutal. They're struggling. They don't know themselves. And the other one is like, this is the best possible season in a human being's life to be there when they're like just trying to figure out which way is up and who they are. And yes, it's brutal. And yes, it's hard. And yes, it takes so much work. But to have the opportunity to make an impact at that moment in their process of self-discovery and revelation is such a gift. And it's just what you're talking about. You know, it's the frame that you bring to an experience that allows you to find that sense of meaning or purpose or not.
You know, as you're talking, I think there is a recurring theme in some of the things that we were discussing. And the recurring theme may sound to many like a compromise or a cop-out or an unnecessary concession. But I think it's important. And the theme is lowering the bar. It's lowering the bar on what constitutes a meaningful life. It's lowering the bar on what constitutes a romantic relationship. It's lowering the bar on what constitutes a healthy relationship. In that, or what is love? And that goes to the work of Barbara Fredrickson about, you know, what is love? And that it's not just that one in a lifetime thing that you find. You can actually cultivate it with many people if you put the work in. So lowering the bar, whether it's on love, whether it's on meaning, whether it's on happiness, I think is important. Making it more realistic rather than a detached from reality.
Yeah. And like you said, I have no doubt that some people will hear that invitation and think, why would I ever want to lower the bar in my life? I want to strive to be the best, to experience the most, to really, to just have it at the highest possible level. And in fact, really coming full circle to the early part of our conversation, when you look at how people experience life, when that is the ultimate aspiration, even when they achieve it, it doesn't make them feel the way that they felt. And yet they sacrifice so much more to be able to get to that place.
Yes, they sacrifice a lot, and inevitably they'll experience frustration. If we set the bar unrealistically high, then no matter what we achieve in reality, we will be disappointed. And again, this is not about compromising on our ability to flourish, far from it. It's about understanding our nature and then taking this nature into consideration, making the most of it.
Yeah, it occurs to me also through this entire conversation that when we kind of zoom the lens out, the ability to focus on any of these things, to be intentional at any of them, is based on a sort of a meta skill of awareness. You know, we can't make any of these decisions. We can't adopt any of these points of view or embrace any actions or practices unless and until we have some level of awareness of who we are and where we are at any given moment in time.
Yeah, awareness is critical. You know, it relates to a topic that I've been thinking a lot about recently, which is what I've come to call rhetorical choices. And rhetorical choices are similar to rhetorical questions. A rhetorical question is a question where the answer is obvious. It's asked for effect. So, you know, if I ask my son, do you want daddy to be angry? You know, I'm not expecting him to, you know, think about it for a while and say, you know, the answer is obvious. Or do you want to be happy? You know, it's obvious. It's a rhetorical question. Similarly, we have rhetorical choices. For example, if I ask you, Jonathan, so do you want to appreciate the good things in your life? Or do you want to take the good things in your life for granted? You know, it's a no-brainer. It's obvious. You ask any person this question, they will say, yeah, of course I don't want to take for granted the good things in my life. And yet, most people, most of the time, take the good things in their lives for granted. Not because they don't know what the right choice is, but simply because they are not aware, they're not mindful of the fact that at every moment in their lives, they can actually choose. So making them more aware of the fact that they have this choice, bringing it to the fore of your consciousness through awareness, through mindfulness, is the necessary prerequisite of practicing the right choice, the rhetorical choice, the choice that will make you happier.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. Yeah. Reflecting on the way that you have brought yourself, your work, your curiosity, inquiry, and research to the world, you know, much of your early days, it happened in a classroom. You taught for, you know, quite a while at Harvard, spoke in to numerous organizations around the world. And it seems like you have sort of like continued to create this expanding ripple of ways to get the message out. The most recent of which, and tell me if this is wrong, but from what I understand, is this Happiness Studies Academy, which really says, okay, so let's take the world of positive psychology and bring in all sorts of other schools of thought, draw from them all, and then create teaching experiences for people. I'm curious about how this came to be and what your intention is with it.
Yes. Yeah, so the Happiness Studies Academy essentially came to be 5 and a half years ago when I was on a flight, a transatlantic flight. And you know, Jonathan, those states where you're, when we used to fly back when you're very tired, but too uncomfortable to fall asleep. So I was in one of those states when a question came to mind. And the question was, how is it that there is a field of study for psychology, which is my field, a field of study for history, biology, you know, medicine, education, business, you name it, but there is no field of study for happiness? So yeah, there is positive psychology, but that's just the psychology of happiness. What about what philosophers had to say about happiness? Lao Tzu, Confucius, Aristotle. What about what historians had to say? Economists How about our great books in literature, you know, Marianne Evans or Shakespeare have to say about happiness? Chinua Achebe, what about what neuroscientists have to say about happiness? Why isn't there a field, or rather an interdisciplinary field of study, that brings together what all these different disciplines, fields, have to say about happiness? And I resolved on that flight to help create a field of happiness studies that brings together philosophy and economics and neuroscience and biology and history and film and literature, and bring these together to shed light on arguably life's chief pursuit, if I were to quote David Hume. And 3 years later, I co-founded the Happiness Studies Academy with the purpose of bringing these ideas to different people. And we have a certificate program, which is a year-long journey where students answer two questions. The first question, how can I become happier? The second question, how can I help others become happier? So again, this is the self-reinforcing loop of generosity, of self-fullness. And we have students from over 60 countries around the world. We teach it in different languages. And this is what provides me with so much happiness, to work with students who are keen to bring about more happiness, more well-being, spiritually, physically, intellectually, relationally, and emotionally, whether it's in schools where they teach, homes where they build a family, among their friends and community, the workplace, in hospitals, in the therapeutic relationship, in coaching, you name it, because happiness is important wherever and whenever we are.
Mm. And that feels like a pretty good place for us to come full circle as well, because I agree with all of that. So sitting here in this container of Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
Give yourself the permission to be human. Give yourself the permission to experience the full range of human emotions, the painful as well as the pleasurable. And by doing so, you fulfill your potential for happiness, not by rejecting emotions, not by ignoring difficulties and hardships, by being real, by being authentic, by being fully human.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's SparkeType. Or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.